The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
With the government facing mounting pressure from the opposition over growing cost of living elements, could we potentially be looking at a September rather than an October budget? And with the holiday season peaking, can Dublin Airport cope with rising demands, particularly as we seem to be in the middle of a COVID surge? And then on an EU level, what is being done to cope with the energy crisis and give us all a greener future? Well, I'm joined by the Minister for Transport, Climate, Environment and Communications, Eamon Ryan. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
Let's talk about that budget first of all. I mean, they're all suggesting that they're getting informed leaks from government sources to say you're bringing it forward to September, the budget.
It's not decided yet. We will decide it probably next week, I would imagine. We've cabinet and we would have to publish what's called a summer economic statement. And that's a very important kind of signal as to what the economic situation is and how much room in the budget does that give us for additional measures. I think it's best to do it not in July. I think whether it's September, October is a relatively minor change one way or the other. But I think that the opposition are also calling for doing everything now. I don't think that would be the right thing for a variety of reasons. Firstly, we've already engaged with National Economic Dialogue last week with social partners, with the trade unions, with business, with NGOs. And I think that partnership approach strengthens us as a country. And if you were just ignore that, and say, oh, sure, we're going ahead with the budget now effectively in July. I mean, people say it would be mini-budget. But we all know that once that money is spent, it would constrict what you could do in September or October. So I think whether it's September or October, we'll decide next week.
What would be the elements in that decision? Would it be simply pressure from the opposition so you don't give them a budget now, but you give them a budget sooner?
Yeah, and because also certain measures take a bit of time to introduce, and it is going to be a difficult autumn and winter period, because we know the war in Ukraine, that the Putin-Russian government is using gas as a weapon in that war. They're throttling back again the supply of gas to Europe, which is putting the price up. That people, unfortunately, are going to see that in their gas bills particularly. Also, there's a knock-on consequence for the electricity bill. So the autumn period and the winter period is the critical one that we need to provide the supports. It's similar to what we did in the last year with about $2.5 billion of additional measures the government did.
One of the things that is characteristic of any budget is that you promise today in the budget statement and then it's delivered the following year sometime.
Exactly.
There's more pressure, though, to deliver immediately. In other words, if you have a budget in late September, that maybe by the end of October, budget measures start being paid out.
Exactly. And that's maybe one of the reasons why you'd be looking at time. But also, I think...
But are you going to do that? Are you going to accelerate payments?
Well, that's what I would hope and expect to do. But also look at one-off payments. Look at the ability to make an immediate change next autumn and winter. We expect, and nothing's certain, but there's a real expectation among most economists now that the inflationary figures will start to come down next year. Exactly how much we don't know, but some of those increases, particularly in energy and food and other ones, won't be repeated. And therefore, we do expect to see inflation coming down. So being able to do things in the autumn and early winter period, I think, is very important.
The question of the army at the airport, you announced the possibility that up to 100 personnel might be deployed in the airport. We've had clarity, I think, that they wouldn't be customer facing. They might be doing perimeter security and so on. And yet we're told that this surge is maybe typical of early summer. It will wane. Or do you know something about COVID that we don't know?
No. And it's only the army are now going on standby and training and getting ready. The Defence Forces, I should say. It'll be members of the Air Corps and Navy as well, potentially. They're there on standby. It is because this period from 6th of July to the 15th of August is particularly tight in terms of very large numbers, actually back even beyond now pre-COVID numbers, so unprecedented numbers going through the airport. There is a real risk. We've seen it, for example, in a number of airlines now starting to cancel flights because they can't get their staff numbers up because of COVID. And in the event, just being on a prudent basis, Dublin Airport approached us, made this point. We approached the Defence Forces and agreed that we should put in place that sort of measure. And it is very much the Defence Forces supporting the state as a civil power in a way to free up their workers to be able to go into the frontline jobs.
But will they be paid the rate for the job? Because they're not paid as much as the DAA security staff who are currently on perimeter duty.
No, all those arrangements, there will be service level agreement between the Department of Defence and Dublin Airport. Dublin Airport paying fully for the allowances and other measures as that they will need. One thing.
Okay, Pat, just clarify that. So the DAA will pick up the tab for the deployment of the Defence Forces.
Exactly. One other point, Pat, though, just to make it clear, and anyone coming through the airport will see it, that isn't the security check going through isn't the only challenge in the airport. There is also a challenge for the airlines because they too have constraints at this time in both their check-in facilities and people would know in the baggage facilities. Mm-hmm. This morning, people have seen a large amount of baggage, which was in that area where the carousels, where the bags come out. Dublin Airport have put in place arrangements where that'll be taken to a separate facility where people will be able to pick it up easier. Again, part of that problem is coming not even a problem in Dublin Airport, but in other international airports where they don't have the handling mechanism to get bags out in time. It's a problem right across Northern Europe. It's a function of the industry having real difficulty coming back from COVID, getting the numbers in place, and also being affected by COVID here.
So do
now.
We know where that warehouse, I presume it's also to stop people going to the airport when they are only going to pick up a bag. They're not trying to embark.
It's to make it easier for people to be able to collect baggage and for couriers to collect them. So that'll start to improve that issue. The other issue, I suppose, which is a real challenge for any passenger who's discommoded, flights being cancelled. And ultimately, that's the decision we had to make in bringing the Defence Forces in. I suppose the other option was, as has happened in a lot of Northern European airports, to cancel a large number of flights. And we decided that wasn't in the interest of the Irish travelling public.
And yet they are being cancelled by the airlines because of their own COVID difficulties.
Yeah, but we can't unfortunately control that.
Were you dismayed by the letter from the American Airlines group? We're talking about Delta and American and Air Canada. Who are concerned about the mess in Dublin Airport?
There's challenges right across Northern Europe. We're not there. But no, you take that letter at face value and you look to solve the problem. And that's what we're doing.
Now, you have spent some days in Europe and some deals were made in terms of going forward with the green agenda. How will those deals affect us?
They're hugely significant. It was a council meeting of the European Energy and Environmental Ministers. There's real agreement now in what's known as the Green New Deal. This is the new European economic strategy for us to switch to renewable power and energy efficiency as our economic future, as well as climate future. And the impetus behind that was always strong because of our climate challenge, but actually the war in Ukraine has accelerated. I mean, listeners will be out there hearing, the Germans are turning back to some coal-fired power stations and so on. And it's true, because the Russians turning off the gas abruptly as they are. But actually what I sensed from the council was real unity and commitment now in the union in terms of stopping our reliance on those fossil fuels. We as a country are one of the most reliant, so we should be and will be at the forefront of that. It's hugely challenging in the scale of ambition. I mean, it includes us in this energy efficiency directive, which we agreed on Monday, an actual reduction in final energy consumption. And for an Ireland, which is a growing population, a very fast growing economy, that will present real challenges.
But one of the quickest things you can do is retrofit houses, insulate them. It might be expensive. We may not have the manpower to do it. But in terms of your energy bill and therefore energy consumption, it's one of the most immediate things.
Absolutely, and that's why we're massively ramping up. And Pat, the change won't happen if it's just a finger wagging, telling people they're to blame. You're doing. It has to be a switch to a better system. And the likes of retrofitting your home, the real attractive thing about that is it's healthier. It's much more comfortable and cozy. It increases the value of the house. And what we've seen since we introduced our major new retrofit scheme, which I think anyone in Europe would say is probably the best and most advanced of retrofitting programs. programmes, there's been a huge response from the Irish public. So that is happening. Just one other thing that was agreed at in the council now was at 2:30 in the morning yesterday morning. So it was one of those ones that negotiated well into the hours. Europe is extending its carbon tax system, if emissions trading scheme it's called, and they're extending it into the home and into transport. One of the derogations we got as a country, because we're already doing that through our carbon tax, is that we won't do double taxation. We wouldn't pay the European tax charge as well as our own. And I think that was a huge gain for the country and recognition that we are actually on the right path.
Some of the comments coming in. I'm about to start building a new house. We're very energy conscious. We're building an A2 or a possibly A1 BER rated house. I'd consider putting solar panels on the house, but the grant is just 2,400. The cost probably around 11,000. So there's no incentive to do it.
Well, there is also an incentive now. We've just changed the rules that you can actually sell the power back onto the... Now, the first best use is use it for your own need, but that is also designed to help make the economic and make the cost work. The payback in solar has changed, like everything. Unfortunately, with this cost of gas particularly going up and the knock-on price of electricity, it is starting to make the cost of solar competitive and the sort of timelines. Previously, it was, if you looked at it, a kind of a 10, 15, 20-year time payback period. That's come back down because now it is...
Because the price of energy is so high, your payback time is quicker.
Yeah, it is a challenge because the solar panels, like so many others, there's a tight supply of both the panels and also the installers at the moment. But that's ramping up. And I think what we're going to see is massive deployment of solar on people's roofs. I was down in Kerry last week and talking to various solar companies who are engaged in it. And they said, again, they're out the door with orders. Their real challenge is getting the workers to deliver it. And I think that's the key constraint.
And of course, that is in conflict with the house building programme and all the rest of it. We just need more workers, and yet we've nowhere to house them when they come from third countries. We will need natural gas until we have hydrogen. Build that LNG terminal now, Minister. This war has years to go.
Well, firstly, we're in a very different situation there is a real risk now in the countries like Germany, Austria, Netherlands, who very much rely on imported Russian gas, that they are looking at LNG and other frantically looking for other supplies because they are at risk of, as that switched off. We're in a different position. We only rely on probably about Russia from gas for about 2 or 3%. Most of ours is either from Carib, from the UK or from Norway. And that supply won't easily divert to other locations because actually a lot of the pipelines, they're Norwegian and UK fields that go straight into the UK and straight to us. So there is a decision in terms of what further gas infrastructure do we develop and deliver. I've just came actually at a meeting earlier on this morning with the European Investment Bank and sharing their kind of our thinking around this. We do have a very significant offshore wind resource. We have a comparative advantage in that. We're a very windy place. We have a very large sea area.
With the best will in the world, and we'll talk about poverty of ambition in this regard in a moment, but with the best will in the world, that's years down the line before we have offshore Atlantic wind resources.
Well, no.
So what do you do in the meantime if you run short?
Well, no, firstly, it's not years away. Certainly, we can deliver it, in my mind, within this decade. And the real question then is how you design it. I don't think what you want is a kind of Klondike developer takes all, kind of decides where it's built and so on. It needs to be state designed and led. And what I was, again, listening to my European colleagues, they're starting to look, and I think we will do the same. You really plan this, where some of that offshore wind you identify for use in the generation of hydrogen. Yeah. That's where you use electrolyzers to convert the electricity into hydrogen and you store that.
You break down water into oxygen and hydrogen, that's how it works. The price of that is obviously critical because you're using electricity to break down water into hydrogen and oxygen, then you have to store the hydrogen and deliver it or whatever. But so can it be delivered at a price?
I believe it can. And just on the timing, I think what the ESB have said on this and their potential timelines before the end of this decade is right. And their economic analysis is also correct. When you get, for example, in Money Point, they're just on the edge of the Atlantic where the power would come ashore and whether you have a very strong grid connection. A lot of the costs and a lot of the challenges around this is where do you have the electricity grid? By bringing the offshore wind ashore there, you can go straight onto our strongest grid connection and power the country. if the wind isn't blowing and you've converted some of that hydrogen, some of that electricity to hydrogen by design, by the way you design your offshore system, you can then burn that at a power station in Moneypoint, use the same grid connection, and that's a hyper-efficient and hyper-secure system.
No.
And that's relying on our own power where no one else...
Okay, we spoke to Pierce Flynn yesterday. He's a man who's set up a company called Green Rebel, which is about supplying the infrastructure that would be needed for offshore platforms for the servicing of windmills and so on. And he's also involved in a green energy, a green hydrogen company. Mm-hmm. And he says there's a poverty of ambition within the government and within the civil service. The planning system is crazy. If you want to sort out something with the foreshore people for a pier in Ballycotton, it has exactly the same, you know, a small thing like a pier in Ballycotton. It got exactly the same status as a €500 million wind farm off the coast.
Historically, that may well have been the case, but that is changing.
How many people are in the foreshore department? Four, or five?
Yesterday, the Dáil just passed a key piece of legislation to allow us to establish now, this year, the Maritime Area Planning Office. And that legislation, which we passed last Christmas, is going to be critical to speed things up. And he's right, we do have to be fast here.
So will you, if you're doing an offshore wind farm, will you bypass on board Planola and go straight to this new planning body?
The process would be this. The first phase of projects, there'll be they're mainly in the East Coast, there's one in the West, but they're mainly along the sandbank running right the way from Dundalk right the way down to Wexford.
Are you concerned, by the way, about the fish spawning areas that will be disturbed
by
the
environmental issues, right? But the consenting of that is happening as we speak. It's in train at this moment. The auction process for that will start this year and be completed early next year. And they will go into onboard Planola because those projects are what they're called legacy projects. They've been planning for 10 years. So it's appropriate to do it that way.
Do you feel comfortable with onboard Planola given their difficulties at the
moment? Yeah, they've got additional staff and additional unit to manage exactly this. The second phase, which as you say, is starting to move into the Atlantic, moving into the south, moving into floating shore and wind. The consent of that will be done in the next 2.5 years. And then they will go into planning. And those projects are the ones where I said, we can convert that into hydrogen and give us a secure gas supply. At the same time, we're planning a third phase, which is 30 gigawatts of offshore wind. And to give a sale of, well, what does 30 megawatts mean? 30 gigawatts mean? Currently, as we speak, I'm looking up the lights here in the studio, we're using about 5 gigawatts. So we're saying we will produce from offshore wind alone, not into solar, we will produce 6 times our needs and make sure that we have a secure
supply. But yesterday
supply.
On the programme, Pierce Flynn told us the Brits are way ahead of us. They are claiming they will be the Saudi Arabia of wind.
In fairness, the Brits are good at this. The British are good at this. They have been ahead on offshore wind. We actually, though, have a far higher percentage of renewable electricity on the system than the British. We went onshore first, and because we had that was a lower cost. Now we're going offshore and into solar. There's no lacking of ambition. If anything, we are aiming to turn this to the major economic future for our country.
Some of the questions coming in. I'm due to upgrade my fleet of vehicles, yet I have to buy diesel cars because there's no VAT incentive on other options. Why is this? That's from Ivan.
Well, the tax system has been constantly, Minister Pascal Donoghue, over a series of budgets now, have continued to amend the tax system to give a clear signal towards going electric and going zero carbon. And that has been done on a kind of slow, steady basis. There is a real need for us, the likes of switching, for example, commercial fleets and looking at the benefit in kind and other every kind of mechanism to make sure that we steer everyone towards this. Again, what we agreed at the European Council the other night was that by 2035, we're not going to have any more combustion engines. No zero carbon combustion engines.
No petrol or diesel cars. They may still be there in commercial haulage and so on.
Exactly.
Unless there's a hydrogen option.
Yes. And so this is coming with a real certainty. There's disruption at this moment because the global supply chain is upended with the lack of semiconductors. But every manufacturer is now providing electric options. And it is going to become the mainstream option within the next 2 to 3 years.
But the point about fleets and so on and, travelling salesmen and women driving electric cars, if the range is OK, is that those cars, after 3 years, will come into the second-hand market, and ordinary people who can't afford an electric car will therefore have access to an electric vehicle.
No, that's one of the changes we will be hopefully in the budget.
In the budget, and what about the BIK, which is about to expire? I think your original plan.
Again, it's kind of looking at a range of different measures to make sure that we do make the switch, particularly those fleet vehicles, because as you say, that then gives you a second-hand market 3 years later.
One here about why did we never get reductions in food and electricity prices when oil and gas was at $30 a barrel? The minute it goes up, the companies pile it on, and we know we've got the most expensive food in Europe, strangely, for food we produce at home. But we never seem to see the reductions in those commodities when the price is at rock bottom.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of excise and VAT on fuels, which means that it doesn't go down below a certain level. But the main problem at this present time, like I know people have different arguments around this, but the truth is we are at risk because it is Russia setting the price. They are actually setting it by cutting supplies and deliberately using energy as a geopolitical tool in this war. And like we shouldn't distract or avoid that reality. And it behoves us as a country because we don't have the Corrib gas field, we've had the Kinsale gas field and Seven Heads gas field in the past, but we don't have significant oil and gas reserves. So we are at risk from international factors setting the price.
One of the elements about our agricultural production, obviously, is the amount of methane that we produce. But the point was made again and again on this program by farming interests is that when it comes to oil, the amount of carbon that we burn in the oil is charged to us as a nation, not to Saudi Arabia or Russia, whoever is providing us with the hydrocarbons. Yet when it comes to food, it's not the countries where the food is consumed who get hit with the carbon. It's the poor producer here. Double standards.
Well, you could look at that in other ways. A lot of our emissions accrue in China, where most of our manufactured goods come from. Like all the materials here in front of us are probably, I'm looking at the headphones now, and made in...
Germany, I hope.
Germany it is, actually.
Yeah. So high-quality stuff here.
So should the Germans be count for that headphone or not? You have to be careful on this. One point, though, in farming, and I was, again, talking with Minister McConnell yesterday on this, we have to come back to what I said earlier about making the switch, and farming has to play its part just as much as everyone else. And we benefit from that green brand. Kerrygold sells in US at twice the price. I was reading the Farmers Journal this morning, twice the price of American butter. And because we have this marketing of correctly that we are sustainable, 40 shades of green. So we have to maintain that. And going back to what I was saying, so farming is going to have to make a huge leap to the top of the range, just like every other sector in climate ambition. The key question is, how can we maintain and develop incomes for farmers as we make this change? It has to be a better system. One of the ways, we don't have gas fields that we can tap into, but one of the systems we could tap into is use some of our grass growing potential in anaerobic digestion, where you take the slurry from the cattle, the slots, and you help solve a pollution problem there. You then generate biomethane that actually we can use here. And I'll take it even further. I was down in Kerry last weekend at the Dingle Hub. Really fascinating, really interesting stuff going on. Brilliant example of bottom-up farmers kind of starting to look at these opportunities, monitoring and managing the things themselves. Could we then use that methane to power the tractors so that the low cost, so the farmers create...
Okay, so you'll have a circular economy within the farm.
I see that as absolutely
farm.
Achievable.
But here's a broader issue, and that is we produce milk with a relatively low carbon footprint. And, you know, the world needs milk, the world needs cheese and so on. Surely we should be calculating the amount of carbon per litre. And therefore, if we are best boy in class, we should be allowed to produce as much as we can to replace those who are high carbon producers.
As long as we don't have what the EPA describe at the moment, our rivers saturated with nitrogen and phosphorus and pollution. Like, we can't do that and destroy our natural world. We have to make sure that as we do
that... But meantime, what is it, a million septic tanks around the country? A sample suggested that half the septic tanks that were inspected were faulty and contaminating groundwater. If that were to be replicated for all of the septic tanks, we've got 500,000 septic tanks poisoning the environment.
Yeah, and the environment is connected to us. If our water systems are polluted, that's our health, that's our wealth, as well as a loss to the environment.
Minister, we could talk all day on these matters, but pleasure. I thank you very much for joining us in studio. Minister Eamon Ryan, thank you very, very much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.